Hi, good evening, everyone. I'm Suri Hong Pareda, and welcome to The Super Collider, a hero of the social network. Sorry, we don't have a remote. So a little while ago, I actually approached Ben, Matt, and Jen to talk about everything that makes our lives exciting, which is our relationships with a lot of different friends who we see in this room. And we got to talking, and I asked, you know, a couple questions about what it is that Ben's background and experience with Flickr, Jen and 2200, and Matt and Doppler, and how they came about to even, you know, basically use, build, and shape emerging social technologies. When I first said the word superclider to a bunch of friends, people thought I was talking about CERN, which I got to visit a couple weeks ago. And in fact, I am talking about my esteemed colleagues. So at this point, I would like for them to spend a couple of minutes to sort of describe a little bit about their history, and then they're going to do short presentations, and then we'll have a conversation together after that. Yeah, sorry. This is basically just a whole bunch of applications that we seem to use in our day-to-day lives. Not all of them, but just to kind of give you an idea of what's out there, who is... Sorry. Who's basically creating these wonderful things for us to sort of facilitate our lives, and that is helping us with the relationships that we build and maintain. So we'll start with Ben.
Hello. Is this on?
Yes.
So I think the conceit of this panel, to answer a question that was raised early on,
sorry,
was that we wanted to sort of speak about the fact that in the kind of mix of different inputs and outputs that we all have in our sort of daily social lives now, there seem to be some of us that are perhaps a little bit more attuned than others, and probably a little bit of an OCD way to the prospect of understanding the social landscape and sort of navigating the situation and really kind of responding dynamically and composing situations in the space of the social. And so I think all of us in different ways have sort of gone native in the social graph, such as it is. And we're sort of going to contemplate a little bit what the ramifications of that are. My experience in this space starts from many moons ago. I was actually spent a lot of time in the early sort of pre-web days on the internet in bulletin boards and Moos and various other ancient structures for socialization online, and sort of have followed that through on into sort of one of the last iterations I participated in was something that became Flickr, which was called The Game Never Ending, which was a massively multiplayer online game that was about a playful activation of social relationships. So the design of that project really was kind of turned into this never-ending meditation more than actual production on the process of how all of those sort of different mediated flows of sort of intersocial information could kind of create new patterns in the way that we collaborated and worked together. So now I've kind of matriculated into the advisor sphere, is how I say it. I'm now working with multiple different companies that are kind of pursuing different vectors in this space. And so a lot of my work actually is very active in the process of, you know, recombining different trajectories of people that I, you know, their work and understanding how they fit together and could benefit from working together. So it's not so much necessarily, you know, my day job, the prospect of how all of these sort of these social things flow together and produce things, but it's definitely something that's always I'm always conscious of, and am, you know, working always to understand how I can benefit from tools that are out there to enable that, and also design tools that could enable it for other people.
Thanks, Ben. My name is Jen Beckman, and I'm someone who comes from a background, an internet background. I've been doing online, my specialization when I first started working in the internet was online community development, and I did that for almost 9 years. And then 5 years ago, I started a gallery in New York. I sort of gave up on the whole internet thing for a while. And my gallery's 5-year anniversary will be next Saturday. And my most recent project, which is something called 20 by 200, has been super exciting for me because it's allowed me to sort of integrate my gallery experience with my internet experience and use a lot of sort of community network tools to, my community sort of has come into play a lot for making 20 by 200 run. And I'm sort of excited to be using the tools for something other than this kind of self-referential. I talked to a lot of community. My online community was other people who were building online community. There was a long time of being in this very insular world of other geeks doing geeky things. Whereas now I get to use the tools for something that has not so much to do with the technology and is more having to do with art and getting people talking about art. And I found that my experience doing community building has come into play a lot.
Hello. I'm Matt Jones. I design stuff. One of the things I design is called Doppler. I'm one of the Matts who works there. The other Matt, Matt Biddulph, is just over there. And last time I spoke at a conference, I was extremely nervous. Not like now, because I'm amongst friends. Maybe. And as a result, I got very flustered, and I described Matt as my technical wife. And he hasn't forgiven me for that. So I'm now going to brand myself as the hand waving husband in Doppler, and you're going to see why probably when I talk a little bit more. But let's continue.
I think we're going to start with Ben's presentation.
Window. Neb.
Yes.
Play.
Thank you. Hello.
Nope, no ads. Play. Oh. Didn't you see Kathy Sierra play?
Oh, right.
Okay.
Right. So, just to contextualize a little bit, where I wanted to start from was this concept that, despite the fact that we may now have tools that sort of concretize the relationships and the flows that we have in our social systems, these relationships and flows have existed for a very long time. In fact, they are culture. And I think there have always been roles, no matter what sort of cultural situation people find themselves in, the size of community that they're participating in, there are always roles in those communities that are about understanding how various members of the community function and understanding how those functions can be multiplied and added and composed into larger projects. And I think that I'm sort of speaking this in terms of projects and production, but I really mean this in terms of both what I would call the work of society and the work of play and the work of, good old fashioned work, the building of things, production. So, I think one of the reasons why the braid metaphor is meaningful to me is that I think there is this sort of cloth or skein or a product which is the cultural product, which is what we're all making together, and the ways in which the individuals that participate in the making of culture come together requires a little bit of choreography, and I think that's kind of the skill that I'm sort of positing that some of us, maybe not just ourselves up here, but I think a lot of us in this room are beginning to understand, because what that skill is based on is an ability to visualize the connections between people and how they can, the ways in which they're moving and the ways in which those movements can be coordinated. And I think that, we now have a lot of people that may not have had that ability inherently are becoming aware of their sort of latent capability to do that because they have exposure to tools that help them visualize those possibilities. And I think one of the basic drivers of that kind of capability is ultimately empathy. the idea that when you're spending time with other people and you're talking to other people, everybody, you're always imagining what it is that other person is doing and what their sort of hopes and fears and aspirations are. And, you know, sort of that's all being stored in your sort of mental model of that person. And therefore, you know, when you're out in the world or when you're moving across the network to talk to someone else and be in a different context, you can keep that model of their desires with you and know what opportunities might, you can just see the kind of osmotic potential of flow of that person's ability to flow into a space that you encounter elsewhere. So it is really like just a cross-pollination of sort of the desire to participate in something and the need for participation in another space. So I think that this process is something that occurs almost naturally. I think people, you know, come together without people that are in specific roles that would be the super collider or the composer of social networks or whatever. I think, you know, people do find community and it's something that, you know, that unfolds naturally. But I do think that there's the process to sort of tend to the opportunity to tend to those processes and to shape them a little bit. And I think that that's, you know, really where the potential for these tools and the potential for these roles lies in the ability to sort of rise above a little bit the prospect of participating in the making or the play or the collaborative improvisation, and instead sort of look at the graph of how all those trajectories of the participants is spreading out, and maybe, you know, nudge them in one direction or another just so that they tangle in the right way and continue to produce the most sort of the richest cloth. I think the other, you know, another multisyllabic observation I'd like to make here is
if you're playing along in Scrabulous, then
is that you know, from my, at least from my perspective or perspectives, as the case may be, one of my roles as well as being sort of a composer is the fact that since I'm sort of a nomad and I move around a lot, and so I come across lots of different people that are working in different contexts, and they sort of are in different headspaces, and they really, you know, are enriched by the sort of news coming from some orthogonal direction from elsewhere across the network, someone else that's working on a similar problem that they don't know, or someone that's working on a totally different problem but has come to similar conclusions. You know, I'm sort of a vector of, mimetic transmission. I'm sort of bringing these thoughts from one group to another and sort of, you know, talking about them in context and making people sort of, you know, reconsider what they're up to based on, you know, maybe a similar process that's unfolding elsewhere. And I think that's, you know, the ability to sort of see the potential resonances in that space is sort of becoming more available to us because we have all of these tools now at our disposal. I think lastly, the thing that, you know, the real sort of super collision metaphor comes into play in the fact that, you know, as we sort of continue to entangle and as we continue to, move together and move apart and, you know, begin to build a framework that makes that more fluid and flexible, it's, you know, out of that fall these social objects, you know, the photos, the videos, the Twitters, like all of these objects now sort of become the sort of particles that are, you know, have been produced by the fact that we're all kind of moving along these different paths and, you know, swerving together in a way again. And we have different ways of continuing to communicate as those things branch and then converge again. So I think that's, you know, part of the work of this social collaboration is also the understanding of what the framework is we're building for that movement.
Thanks.
When I talk about, it's interesting listening to Ben talk, because there's definitely this sort of less concrete idea about how we are moving across borders and things like that. And then for me, a lot of the opportunities that I've had using community tools has been to make my world bigger, and to make the challenge I've had with the gallery since I opened has been that the physical space is very small. And one of the things that was very exciting for me in having the background in community development has been that I can use different tools at the point that I opened the gallery, actually just being on the internet as a gallery was still sort of a big deal. And using the tools to have a much bigger presence than I could have in my small physical space, and using the tools to connect people who were very far flung with 20 by 200, for starting at the very beginning, a lot of what we did, this is the homepage for 20 by 200. We used a lot of IM. The entire site was built with very few of us being in the same room together ever. And we did a lot of collaboration over Instant Messenger. Our designers are in Ohio and Colorado, and our developer and integrationist were in Brooklyn, and I was at the gallery. And just being able to do everything sort of virtually enabled us to produce something really quickly, and because all of us were sort of fluent with the tools and with the internet, we were able to not have to have an office space, basically, and to also just be able to be in our own productive in our own way in our own space, and yet collaborating at the same time. And I did my creative brief with my designers over IM, and it was actually much easier for me an easier conversation for me to have than having to prepare some kind of document or notes, to just have him ask questions and for me to answer was just a way for me to communicate that was much easier. And we used movable type as our back end, to build a site quickly. And, you know, to me, having been around for the sort of 1.0 version of the web, and now using 2.0 tools, the thing that the biggest differentiator has been you don't have to build everything yourself. And there are all these different things that you can integrate together without having to come up with a whole framework. The most powerful tool for me sort of remains, it's neck and neck between, I would say email and IM. And, the way 20 by 200, actually, I'll step back and say what it is. It's a website where I announce limited edition prints twice a week. And, the prints are only available online. And, most of the sort of sales of the prints happens directly from my mailing list. I write a newsletter where I talk about, in a very first person, personal way about why I'm engaged with the piece that we're announcing, and it goes out to my list ahead of time. And again, this is a way for me to kind of communicate with a really broad audience about art in a way that they might not have been exposed to art before. And then I have a blog as well, and I use a blog to communicate to a different audience about the different editions that I introduce. And then again, Flickr is another audience. You know, each one of these places where I sort of am doing broadcast stuff is reaching a very different sort of sector of people that I know. And you know, the mailing list is people who come from art. The blog is actually not so much a technical group of people, but more so people who I know from the design world when I wrote a blog about design for a long time. And then Flickr is the way that I keep in touch with a whole audience of, you know, my people that I know from San Francisco and just people who are looking at media in a different way. And then, you know, Twitter is the final frontier of communicating with it's a whole new layer. And actually this is a good example. If you look at our followers, it's shameful. We only have 62 followers, and I'm surrounded by power Twitter users. I've sort of reached some fatigue with these tools. Every time I announce an edition, there are so many different cycles that I have to go through between writing the newsletter and sending that out with the special software to track to compose a newsletter, to then getting it on the blog, and then putting it up on Flickr, and then putting it out on Twitter, and just sort of trying to communicate across all these different networks. And then somebody says, oh, well, you know, you should have a Facebook group for it. Or I mean, I just want like I want I kind of want people to come to me rather than having to go across all these different networks. And I swear to God, every time I open my inbox, I'm being invited to join a new social something or other. And there's a point of diminishing returns. I mean, Twitter actually, for me, being here, it's been the first time that it's had a utility to me that I don't have in my day-to-day life. I'm kind of in this weird, I have a foot in both worlds, having, you know, worked in technology before, and now I'm becoming more and more of an end user, of someone who, I'm not exactly, you know, I'm just using tools to use them. And if they're not useful to me, they sort of fall to the wayside. And Twitter is something that's actually really difficult to explain to, you know, my mom or an artist who I work with. They don't have any kind of context for it. And then finally, I use my networks, and this is actually something that gives me quite an edge among other gallery owners. I've been looking at the internet for photographers and artists from day one, and that was pretty it was pretty unconventional at the point that I opened. There's a lot of snobbery in the art business, and people are looking for certain credentials and all that stuff. And I've always been interested in the democratizing nature of the internet. And I've always been interested in finding people who aren't pursuing the traditional paths. And, you know, the internet's always been great for that. So, with 20 by 200, part of the fun for me has been looking around on different sites and seeing what kind of art people are posting. And we have my ever-present Adium list at the side. Most gallery owners that I know in New York have never heard of Found. And, you know, Found is an uneven experience, obviously. And, you know, the more I use it, the better it gets for me. And because I know how to use it, and don't become overwhelmed by it because I have this background of this kind of network communication, it's easier for me to navigate through it. And then, of course, I have like a whole, you know, category on Delicious and a network on Delicious that shows me stuff that I might not have seen otherwise. And you know, this is an edition that I did with a illustrator named Lindsay Hunter, who I read about, I don't know, 10 different blogs. I saw mentions of her illustrations based on spam lines. And I just contacted her and asked her if she wanted to do an edition, and she was happy to do it. And again, I think that this is a good example of how I'm able to use my background with different tools to do things that other people in the art business are not likely to do. And then again, you know, in terms of looking, you can see my fat feed reader with about 500 different blogs. And then the other thing that I find quite interesting is that a lot of the artists that I work with have their own networks. And to me, that's kind of the multiplying effect of 20 by 200 that's really interesting, is that each week I introduce two new artists who have their own networks that they're reaching out to via blogs and via, you know, via mailing lists that they have, and bringing them into the loop of 20 by 200. This is another artist, Jason Poland, who has a blog, where he does an illustration every day, a drawing, and he gives it away. He's good. And then this is me getting my constant feedback from the network that people make fun of me about. But I have a long list of, and again, you know, none of this is probably very innovative to you, but as someone who works in the gallery business, this is pretty outrageous. Like, people are like, you can find out things about yourself on the internet. Can I control those things? I don't get it. You know, and I have an ability to sort of be a feedback mechanism for the artists who I work with in a way that they didn't even know existed. And again, this is a very sort of prosaic, you know, practical implementation of tools that, you know, people, they just don't know about them. And I think that that's where a lot of my energy and excitement comes from about this project, is being able to employ these tools to connect collectors to artists, to connect artists to their audience, and to sort of show them tools in a way that there's a very practical application. This is I decided to put this up because this is a blog post from a collector who I work with. The Times did a profile of me, and he wrote a post about it, and he uses blogs.com, and he uses different font sizes, and he has an audience. I mean, you know, he's using the tools, and he's using them in his own way, and you know, it's great to see them kind of crossing over to that broader audience. The end.
Shall I just swap?
Sure.
One swap seats.
Okay, sure.
So, hello again. As some of you might be wondering why you had these glasses in your bag, if you could put them on now, that would be really helpful. It took a lot for me to get them in all of those bags, so adjust. Play. Oop. fail. Here we go. Ready? Glasses on.
Success.
Yeah. So what you can see so when Siri asked me to talk about super colliders, I got incredibly excited because I thought she was talking about the Large Hadron Collider in CERN, and I thought I'd spend about 10 minutes just reading out some of these labels. Ring imaging Cherenkov detector.
I saw that.
Muon identifier. And my favorite of all, the time expansion chamber. But that probably isn't that educational. And neither is what's going to follow. Because I'm going to talk about, first of all, I'm going to talk about monkeys. We love monkeys in Britain. To the extent that many of our most prominent scientists study a lot of them. I don't know if Robin Dunbar has been invoked yet. I know this is very 2003 of me. But if you are following along with an anthropology drinking game, please go ahead. So Dr. Robin Dunbar, anthropologist, studied the kind of growth of language and conversation. He wrote a book called Gossip, Grooming, and the Birth of Conversation or something like that. You can fisk me later with that one. When I typed in, I found this. I love this. The Grooming Guys, the only blog that makes you more handsome when you read it. Grooming is what super colliders, I guess, do. They're kind of done. Everybody kind of, who knows what I'm referring to when I talk about the Dunbar number? Okay, so Robin Dunbar proposed that our ability to form groups or to manage groups in our head was limited by our brain architecture, and that we had evolved, from the savannah to modern humans to a level where from groups which were sort of 20 to 60 to being able to manage about 140 to 160 people, kind of the canonical Dunbar number is 150. Super colliders, through their use of these technologies, I would imagine are kind of, busting through that Dunbar barrier fairly heavily. When I was looking up, Robert, trying to get this graph, I actually found this one, which I thought was not used that much. This is out millions of years ago. Always good to have a graph with millions of years on. The long now of PowerPoint here. The grooming times have gone from 20 minutes to over 40 minutes in millions of years. Learn from that what you may. Super colliders are probably spending a lot more than 40 minutes picking ticks out of their various people on their Twitter follow list. How much I'll leave to the super colliders to talk about. This was my technical wife last night. I think blowing my internal Dunbar stack should be the phrase of the conference. When I wanted to talk about building these tools, I wanted to talk about why it's in some ways it's dangerous to build for super colliders, to build for these people, because they'll kind of compose it all themselves anyway. And one of the things I wanted to talk about was when we were building Dunbar, I also wanted to coin a new phrase, which is how to avoid Dunbarrassment, which I think is when you've met somebody over your 150 level. Yes, of course we did, etc. So anyway, tools for super colliders. How can we use technologies as a social exoskeleton? Inspired by last night's party, I think. It's important to kind of build from the things that we learned from the anthropologists and the sociologists, build from the human. Doppler, who uses Doppler here? Bless you. who's going to keep using it when we start charging you? Thank you. But we're not going to start charging you, so it's fine. Sorry. No exclusive there, sorry. But we're a tool about increasing the level of serendipity in the world. And I will show this one if you've seen before. This is my favorite definition of serendipity. Serendipity is looking in a haystack for a needle and discovering a farmer's daughter. Giving super colliders that kind of exoskeleton to kind of retrieve farmers' daughters is very important to us. The diagram I did about a billion years ago, based on a talk by J.C. Hertz at ETEC a billion years ago, which was about kind of where tools kind of fit in this kind of Dunbar-esque savanna of the internet. I think probably Doppler is somewhere more on the kind of 1 to 2, 2 to 20 side than perhaps the kind of some of the kind of Scoble-esque greater than 150 mega savanna of people. And so a lot of our design decisions have been definitely about not those people at the edge of the graph, but the people who have got kind of the buddy list circle of friends type management. So we're kind of a tool for the strong ties, we think, but that's where we've started off. But we're kind of moving to increase some of that kind of weak tie, serendipity, super collision stuff as well. But we wanted to start out from those kinds of principles because, and I had is Eric Marcuria here? Hey, we had a really great conversation at lunch/breakfast where we were talking about this. We're kind of moving in baby steps away from kind of the strong tie, but really, really slowly, because we think it's really important to kind of reduce the embarrassment in the world and kind of keep the kind of plausible deniability. And so we took some decisions about how we were going to form links, and one of the ways that we started off was that you don't add friends to Doppler, you share information. You kind of plug leads into people and share information. It's kind of a feed rather than declaring something about a relationship. And that's something which is quite hard to. It was swimming against the flow of a lot of the kind of networks out there, which were more about the kind of being increasingly public and then deciding what to put private. We've kind of gone the other way around, and we do have some of that stuff. This is the only screenshot of Doppler I'm going to show, which is my favorite tab, which says others you might know, is the most kind of vague language we could possibly put around FOF. But it kind of works out. But the important thing is is to give people clues about these others and allow people to kind of scent who to share this information with and not to in the tools for school. And in terms of being able to detect these clues, to get these new kind of senses, Matt Webb, who's another British Matt, if you choose to subscribe to other Matts, that's allowable. He gave a great presentation at Reboot. I think Stephanie was there. He was talking about basing tools on human senses. And one of the things he was talking about was scent. And I just wanted to show a project which is not to do with Doppler, but it's by one of Doppler's developers, a guy called Tom Insom, who's an irascible genius, who is around here somewhere, who tells me, I'm sharing a room with him, he told me I snore like a MacBook Pro being put into a wood chipper. And only your friends can tell you those things on the internet. But he wrote this program here called Shelf, which you can get from jerakine.org. I think it's shelf.jerakine.org. And this is one of these kind of remembrance engine things that's kind of continually, sniffing the backsides of the other apes on the savannah and returning it in this little thing and go and investigate that. I think these are going to be kind of the super collision tools of the next kind of 2 years or so. I'm avoiding dumbarrassment is hard, but... And making these decisions has, definitely sort of had an, it's something that we've made positive design decisions about, and it's made our growth kind of very steady. But do you want me to move on from this slide? I'm really enjoying it. But the reason for doing that is that it's that it, we did want to start off from our position and work outwards. And after Merlin Mann's presentation about thought leadership, I thought I mustn't, you know, use cliches like put the toothpaste back in the tube without having some empirical evidence. So I'm just going to present this small experiment in empirical thought leadership. Look at those shakes. That's the party. Here we go. Conclusive proof. I think you'll find that it's better to kind of move outward slowly from some of these decisions. Anyway, that's all I had to say. Sorry for the warts and all.
Thank you, Matt. Thanks, guys. Matt, I have a quick question about Doppler. So in the beginning, when you...
We're not charging. That was a joke.
I'd still pay. But in the beginning, when you created this tool, how was it that you actually got people to use it? I mean, I know Ben had mentioned that he's quite a nomad. And
yeah.
I mean, I know you're in London, Jen's in New York. Ben, at any time, is anywhere in the world.
We did kind of play on that kind of cheesy beta invite-only thing to start off with for a number of reasons. So one thing was, one part of it was we were building in public. So we generally wanted to kind of control the growth and have a collection of people who are using it to start off with who would be very vocal about what we'd done and tell us and feedback very quickly. And there's still kind of, there's a community of about 1,000 people who we can release features to earlier who kind of tell us exactly where we're going wrong very vocally. But we definitely sort of gave out invites to people who we thought were kind of, you know, patient zeros,
right,
who would, you know, were kind of typhoid Marys of these kind of invitation culture, I suppose.
And
that was very deliberate, and it worked out very well. But I mean, the other part about the way that we designed it is because it's so important that for these things to work, that you actually have a network. Actually, jump-starting that is a really careful thing to try and do, I think. So, and I think that's part of what Ben was talking about with the kind of the kind of composer or choreographer role, right, that you know that certain people play. And we definitely, you know, fairly brazenly sort of went after those people to start off with.
So is there a favorite piece of feedback that you received that you guys incorporated into Doppler?
Oh, gosh. I don't like the color that San Francisco is. It's a shitty brown. No, I don't know. Matt, you think? Okay. I mean, I'd probably a lot of the stuff that we've had is about some of the way that the mental model of nearly every other service and our service kind of collides. And moving from bridging between one and the other is something that we're trying to do very rapidly. So we've had a lot of people who's, I mean, as I was saying, I was talking with Eric today, and Eric was sort of saying, I really want to put this stuff public. And it's like, well, you know, a lot of people don't. So we're trying to move that way gradually without sacrificing any of the kind of early design decisions. Okay.
Ben, you move all over the world any time of the day. I think sometimes I actually figure out where Ben is by looking at other people's Flickr streams. Can you tell us, you know, I know that you're an advisor to a couple different companies. Can you tell us how your process is for using these tools, what you prefer, and whether or not you're suffering from any kind of tool fatigue like Jen has?
I mean, part of the reason why I'm definitely sort of constantly sort of in flow, like sort of moving between this fugue state of different opportunities that I'm participating in. So I'm always, you know, cycling through places and context for productivity. And I think that's kind of one of the reasons why, you know, when I was talking about vicarious aspirations before, it was also this vicarious fluidity. Like, I think a lot of times people just don't, most people aren't kind of moving as fast through those different situations as I am. So I think that in a lot of ways, I can always imagine what they would be like if they were in that state. And so I'm liberating them on their behalf just for a moment to think about what their, you know, I mean, liberation is kind of a qualitative word. They're probably perfectly happy in the lives that they have for themselves. But I'm sort of, you know, playing sort of a hypothetical game with what, you know, where might they jump to? And I think that, you know, in doing that, it's always sort of interesting to watch where people's, you know, that's one of the really great things about services like Flickr and Twitter is that they are constantly, you get a sense for where people's heads are at, you know, not just, you know, Doppler, which is where they're physically at, but also, you know, the sort of, you know, where are my thoughts going, you know, and even sometimes to the extent that the person who's actually projecting those statements or those images may not even sort of recognize that they're actually what they're actually, you know, where it looks like their thoughts are going, you know. So it's sort of, in some ways, it just what taking that in is a process of, you know, trying to see, you know, the resonances between two different outflows of information from different people or more, you know, and sort of bringing all of that together by just spending a lot of time. Kind of in this tidal flow of taking things in and putting things out and taking things in, it's almost like a diastolic process of the metabolism of the whole social network. You know, it's there, everyone's kind of putting something out there and taking something in and putting it out, and in those kind of like processes, you get
over and over,
over and over. Yes, you get these you get kind of a cycle that's, you know, almost like a protein cycle or something, this productive process. It's like sort of the life of the whole network. And so if you can kind of, you know, if you can kind of unfocus your eyes enough to see that process emerging, then you kind of, you know, through, you know, this big dashboard of all these different tools, there are patterns in the way that things are flickering across them, so to speak.
Thank you. Jen, you sort of mentioned how the art world is a bit snobby when it comes to, you know, galleries and new business coming into the scene. They're very traditional in the ways that they communicate with one another. How have you seen this technology sort of help you form new relationships online with your offline networks? Is the community in the New York art world even receptive to sort of all of these new
I think increasingly that's the case. I mean, I think that a lot of my experience, less with maybe other galleries, but more with artists, mm-hmm. has been in working with artists and showing them how, like, the network can help them and the opportunities, you know, the opportunities for distribution and reaching a wide audience and sort of like making people aware of you that they don't quite understand and know about. And I think, you know, increasingly other, you know, galleries are catching on to that. But still, I was at an event and one of the things, it was a group opening for a museum. It was a big group show. And I went and had a meal with a bunch of the artists who were in the exhibition. And it was 30 some odd people in the exhibition. And none of these artists had spoken to each other, and they said that they were disappointed that the museum didn't enable any communication between them. And I was talking about this with somebody else, and they said, well, you know, it's really expensive to do that. And I was like, well, you could just make a mailing list. It's not a big deal. But I think that that's me sort of being on this side of the table, because it's not actually easy. It remains not easy for most people. And I think that one of the other interesting things that I, listening to Matt talk about Doppler and sort of like having all this information flow about yourself out in the universe, and like you kind of forget, like you Twitter something and you forget that you have 100 people following you. And so someone comes up to you at a opening and they're like, hey, so how was your trip to Austin? I heard that you got really drunk last night.
That's and embarrassment.
There you go. There it is. And I think
for
that
definition.
It's really like you forget what your network is. And you know, actually I signed up for Doppler recently and I was sitting there typing away and suddenly I stopped because I was like, I don't really know. I don't want to forget who knows. I don't want to forget who's looking at my information and then have somebody know where I am. Without, you know, not because, and it's not a shortcoming of Doppler, it's a shortcoming of me, where I forget sort of who I'm communicating with. And I forget, and I want levels of, I mean, another way this comes up for me is with Delicious. Like, I use Delicious as my bookmarking tool because I'm in different places all the time. And I don't really want to share with my network the, and Flickr is like this for me as well. I don't necessarily want to share with my entire network the artists that I'm looking at. I don't necessarily want to share, you know, all my photos with everyone. But on Flickr, it's like I have, you know, you have contacts and friends and you have friends and family. And I've found that there's this other layer emerging, which is like, it's cool if you know that I'm in Austin and like where I'm going to be later. But I want to be able to slice and dice my audience a little bit more. So like with Delicious, I wish that I could say I have like an inner circle that I give access to. Or with Doppler, I want to be able to say like, okay, it's like there's different levels that you reveal about yourself, because I think that the tendency from a less sophisticated user is it's about protecting their privacy, which I think that as internet people, like, we all think it's cool, like, whatever, because mm-hmm. we were only looking at each other for a really long time. But I can tell you, having like lived in like the sort of civilian world for the past few years, like the amount of information that people can find out about me that aren't people like us who like cull different information, like they cull different conclusions from that information, becomes a little bit more problematic. And so that's part of where my fatigue comes from, which is not so much that, you know, I want to be alone or like it is sort of, I think that this, having sort of come up with all these tools and sort of having this very open attitude right. about communication.
But, I mean, one of the things that I think is, I mean, Jean Poisson was clapping there. I don't know why particularly, but I'll try and guess using my mirror neurons. The mental model that we have a lot of these services, we tend to think that they all work the same way. So John's service, which is Radar, works in a very different way to Flickr. It's not about publics. It's about strong bonds. It's about a succession of small private groups that share with each other. And so I hope that in the next sort of few years, there's going to be more of a kind of language to describe the different ways that we make these.
Well, that's what, yeah, that areas. Was sort of the different set of containers that sort of the tools and the frameworks that fall out of this, is that you sort of, one would hope that, you know, in trying to imagine how these different works can come together, collaborations to come together, is also not just a question of the, you know, there's sort of venue, you know, the mm-hmm. place in which that happens. And it seems like there's more and more, there's sort of a choice of where that, you know, whether it's a physical space or a, mm-hmm. you know, a space in the software, you know, that connects us, like either of those things, you know, have different affordances that, you know, mm-hmm. in some of this compositional work, you know, hopefully there's an intuition about which of those contexts.
Can I ask you two a question? Mm-hmm. When are we going to let these people ask questions?
We're
going to
do it right now.
Excellent.
We have about 10 minutes left. So, I'm sorry, 15? Okay, excellent. So if there's anyone that has a question for any of us, it'd be great.
Do you have Molly to go to the microphone?
Yeah, you have to go to the microphone.
I know Molly doesn't have to go to the microphone. Do you?
Molly should also be up here, by the way, just so that everyone knows. She's an alpha super collider.
Super vet. You want to come up here?
There's somebody
with us.
Before you, Molly. So, why don't you ask your question?
She's coming up on stage.
Is it on? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Closer?
Can I sit by your
So this is kind of a joke question. I want to know where or how you keep track of all of your passwords.
It's a problem. Everybody in my office sort of knows my passwords now because I'm constantly forgetting, and it's a disaster.
And then I know that you had Plaxo up there, which
right.
is like to me it's sort of a management tool of all my other information. Is there other applications like that you see arising that help you to sort of manage this Super Collider life that you have? That was my next.
I think.
Well, go ahead. No, go on, Ben.
Well, I think it sort of. I mean, all of the social networks are now sort of becoming places where you can stash contact information. It's just they're contextualized contacts. So, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sure people have used the Facebook application on iPhone, particularly, is kind of a shockingly good alternative to the native contact manager, and that it basically has people who have shared their phone numbers. You can just kind of navigate across and be calling someone, you know, from an ostensible web application faster than you thought it was possible. So there are just a lot of, every place where your friend network lives, there are kind of different affordances, different permutations of how good that is to store your stuff. So, I mean, Plaxo being, you know, explicitly about that is something that sort of stands farther out about contact management, but, you know, everywhere, you know, a lot of people, you know, it's interesting to see like a service like Flickr, which is not necessarily built around the idea of contact management, becomes a place where people email each other using Flickr's internal mail system because they just don't have each other's actual email addresses. And they know, oh, that person's my contact in Flickr, so I'll just email them there. And I think everyone has these kind of strange, you know, in a way it sort of reinforces the venue for their relationship. They're like, oh, this is the person that I email on Flickr. And so it becomes, you know, that's a Flickr friend. And therefore, you know, that's where the channel of communication happens as opposed to a LinkedIn friend or a friend in a different context. And I think all of those different contexts have implications or connotations about how you relate to that person.
I actually, it's interesting to hear, again, to hear you talk about it because I can't, every time I get a Plaxo invitation, I delete it because it feels like spam. Yeah. And when people email me on Flickr, I delete it because it's people. I mean, and again, this goes back to the network fatigue thing. It's like that levels of access thing. I can't check my Flickr. I have 450, and it's not like, oh my God, I'm so popular.
But do you accept them on LinkedIn then?
No.
So
and I have a note on LinkedIn that says, if I don't know you, I'm not going to add you as my friend. And that's actually going back to this levels of access thing is like, there's this weird sort of social awkwardness, which is like, maybe I don't want to include you in my network. And how do I tell you that politely, you know, like that it, you don't want to. And again, it's like, it's interesting to me, you know, sort of how people experience these different things. And I mean, I understand that Plaxo is a tool for a lot of people. It's like, it makes sense. It makes it automates a lot of stuff. It makes it easier. But like, to me, it feels invasive in certain instances.
Plaxo scares the hell out of me. Mm-hmm. One thing that reminds me of though is, some of Dana Boyd's work.
Molly, you should introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Molly Steenson. I have more than 800 Facebook contacts and I think I actually know all of them. I super collide with these guys all over the place, and what else should I say? But no, it does strike me that wasn't it 1996 when real names or whatever was going on the internet so that you didn't even have to remember domain names? It seems like Facebook has been as deeply successful as it has been, or Flickr in part, for contacts and for keeping in touch with people, just because I can't remember everyone's email addresses anymore, certainly not when people change companies or their domain names expire. So there's almost a genericism that makes it happier. But I had a question for the panelists.
Mm-hmm. He was first, though.
He was first.
He's first. Jeez, I'm sorry.
Hi.
Sorry, Molly.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. If you want to go first.
Go ahead. You've been standing a while.
I do more work with real-world communities. And I've been, you know, finding out, you know, in the Macintosh world, I've built a personal brand around ubiquity, but realizing ubiquity is a brand of youth. It's hard to maintain, to be everywhere or find the right three places to seem to be everywhere and make the connections. I'm just wondering to what extent you find adding online contacts takes away from either depth of connection or the number of real world contacts.
I would say that there is you know, that's kind of what I was talking about in terms of the diastolic process, which is the crazy word I use for it, but the sort of idea that you have, you have different depths that you're experiencing with different set of contexts at different times. And so as the sort of the focus of the you know, the sort of the work of your community, you know, can shift, you know, it's not a static, the way that, you know, because you have sort of this superset of community in which, you know, so maybe that's the issue, is that there's sort of a Dunbar focus, maybe the lens with which you can actually operate inside of is underneath that ceiling of people. And then there's kind of, you know, so the people that are moving in and out of that space of activated people that you're thinking about, you know, those people are the ones that you're having, you know, a deeper connection with, you know, at the time. And then as you move place or context or, you know, sort of social, orientation, those people, you know, fade in and out of your sort of active state. And I think that's, you know, something that is potentially accelerating, certainly for someone like myself. You know, I think that there's a lot of, you know, this kind of moving in and out of different people in my consciousness. But I think that there are a lot of, you know, everyone who's participating in these social networking systems, you know, now has this kind of, you know, is developing a way to, you know,
fogging algorithm.
Yes. The fog of friends. Is that what it is? This is some sort of the way that people have focal depth, I guess.
Well, I also think that, I mean, for me personally, I've been able to extend relationships that would have otherwise sort of shriveled up just because of distance or time or, you know, whatever, because, you know, I'm able to kind of, Flickr is a good example of this. And I'm able to sort of keep a lot of people who I'm different levels of close to up to date without having to pick up the phone, which is like a very disruptive process for me most of the time. And so I think actually it allows me in a lot of ways. I mean, there's like a point of diminishing returns, but for the most part, my experience so far has been that it allows me to have meaningful relationships with many more people than I've been, you know, sort of previously was able to have. And that was the excitement of the internet for me too, when I first started using it, was this ability to kind of communicate in a sustained sort of meaningful way for, you know, across a long period of time.
Jen, can I add something to what she just said? Over the summer, I did a study with Red Associates in Denmark on how social networking tools change the nature of friendship. We did the study in London and Shanghai and took a look at how these things shift. And what we found is, in general, we determined that there were friends of benevolence and friends of utility, and that the friends of benevolence are, you know, a very small group that you do anything for, and that it's deeply context sensitive, or that it's context irrelevant. You do something for these people, but that we have an ever-increasing network of friends of utility, which we must continually activate. And we do activate, which is positive, but exactly what you're saying, the flip side of this is that you feel indebted to it in a certain way, and you're keeping connections live in this network a lot longer than you might otherwise. And it was fascinating to see how this is happening in places that aren't Silicon Valley, but rather, you know, Shanghai 16-year-olds and London 40-year-olds.
I think it also helps sort of accelerate the relationships. I know that, absolutely, you know, for us personally, we've probably communicated much more online than we have in real life. So this is probably only a handful of times that I've actually seen Molly, but I feel close to Molly because we actually communicate on a fairly regular basis.
Almost daily sometimes.
Yeah. So, I mean, in that way, you know, I think it depends on who the relationship is that you actually start the relationship with the person, who they might have come from. I mean, if it's any friend that came from any of these friends that have, you know, are sitting at this table with me, then I'm actually at a comfort level that allows me to sort of accelerate that relationship online. And then I'll just feel as though these people are, you know, closer to me through these tools.
But to the questioner's point about ubiquity, I think one of the things that, to me, which is very important, is the way that these tools play within different contexts in the real world, and the role of cities, and particularly certain patterns of cities as super colliders. I mean, I'm not sure that, I mean, you live in LA, you live in New York, you live
everywhere,
in hubs somewhere.
Nowhere.
But being a dodgeball, everybody knows what dodgeball is.
Yeah.
It's kind of, it got bought by Google, And then sort of rolled out across the world. But its heart was still in New York, if you like. And New York was its kind of game board. And it didn't work outside of, it didn't work in Phoenix. You know, it didn't work in an ex-urban city. And so the patterns of the physical environment and how they interplay with these tools and how, you know, they kind of either amplify or subtract from the effect of these tools is something that probably is for another panel. But there we are.
Hi. I want to call attention first. There's more people with questions here if you don't know.
Oh.
They're super great. They're just sitting down. But the question I have, it might be more geared to Ben, but anybody's willing, welcome to answer. I want to know what you guys think about social colliders plus network tools, what that's doing to social colliders' influence on communities in terms of evolutionary.
Is that part of your research paper?
I was going to say, I think this is a little bit of a loaded question, Tikva, but we'll go with that. Yeah.
I know you.
Very quick answers.
Yeah. We got to move through. I think that the way that it's, you know, this cyborg function, right? There's all these different, there's different ways that these tools are, you know, extending our own abilities. And I think that, you know, certain people just have, aptitudes with certain tools, you know, and so I think that there not only do people have inherent abilities to recognize social landscapes and understand how you know what the flows are there, but also there are, you know, they have aptitudes in the space with the tool, and so sometimes those are really big amplifiers and sometimes they're not. So I think there's the potential for multiplication, turning, you know, that turns someone's relationship, you know, with their social context into something very different. And then there are other people who aren't really affected by the addition of the tools because they still are dealing in a lot of people, you know, especially people I think that find themselves empathic, like to deal with people rather than, you know, machines that deal with people. So it's sort of, you know, there are two different types of people, I think, in that space. And so there's two different results of the combination of the tools and the person.
Should we go to the next question?
Yeah. I think we only have a couple of minutes left. Hello, Kevin.
So there's two threads that seem to join together in this panel. So you talk about super colliders, but really you're super colluders. You work together.
and you're, because it's a you're shadowy going around, conspiracy.
Super fun.
But that's the point. You're the kind of people who start conversations and connect people together. And there is this sort of myth of influencers that the marketers are chasing, saying there are these people that we tell them and they will tell the world and everything will happen. Mm-hmm. And the point is, you know, even if they told you, you'd say, I don't want to tell anyone that. Because you're applying the filter and you're actually doing what you're doing, only spreading things that make sense and making connections where you have your mirroring of somebody else. So I had a question there somewhere. that was it. So yesterday the there was the panel on when the audience revolts, and we had the moderators of multiple communities talking about this and how they did it. I noticed that they were all the same kind of person again. And they were the kind of person who would start these conversations, maintain the communities, and keep stuff going. And my sense is that this is a skill that is not well valued and not well named. We don't really have a word for person who makes conversations happen and stops bad things happening when groups of people get together.
I really like Ben's social composer. Anyway.
Well, I think actually, just as an aside here, that maybe we should let Suri take this one because there's something to be recognized here, which is the meta super collider, which is the person who has wrangled super colliders into a conversation. The other thing that's interesting about what Suri's role is that she's kind of on the edge of there's a role in industry which is the agent, right, which is someone whose job is to actually bring people together with projects, but now they're sort of this space that's post agency, which is, you know, where Suri kind of lives, is in this space of, you know, how does that matriculate? How do these dynamic and kind of self-organizing social connections then organize into something that is part of an industrial project, you know, entertainment industry project or whatever? So that one's to you.
Thank you. Although now I think I've forgotten the question.
Oh, sorry.
What are you? Well, it's actually I think what am I is sort of what is my job, and my job description is the hardest thing. And I actually love my job, so it's not one of those things where it's, oh, I am my job. But I spend a lot of my time basically facilitating relationships between big corporations and single individuals, and also people who have ideas and want to spread them, but they don't quite know who they need to talk to. And for some reason, I've found that I'm quite curious about people in general, so I like to spend a lot of time making friends and learning about, you know, who these people are. And eventually, at some point, the one weird thing about being I wouldn't say, you know, super clutter, but I have a superpower of sort of remembering people's names, where I met them, and, you know, what they do. And at some point, I can go into this head and go, oh, Ben, you should talk to, you know, Ori. And
such a certain
and
voice.
I can find you like a chopper pilot in Nepal. I can, and true. I have. So, I mean, it's, you know, there are these really weird random things, but I can't say that, you know, how do you monetize these relationships? You know, basically you hope that you do it.
You click the box on Happy Net Box.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. But you know, I basically really enjoy facilitating conversations between people and sort of helping bridge those relationships for people, and have in a very awesome way found a, you know, person, Entertainment Media Ventures, to allow me to sort of do this as a living. So I do find a lot of value in, you know, starting conversations for people.
Next question.
Yeah.
I'll try to make this one quick.
Hi, Ori.
Hi. Jen brought up a good point about when people are outside of your tech-savvy circle and they all know how to use Google, and I'm sure we've all had the experience of some distant relative or something looking something up about you, totally out of context. But what is the actual disadvantage of that? Can anyone on the panel like give some concrete examples of how that's actually affected you?
Yes. Can I take that? Yep. I've spent 12 years working with technology and now 16 with online community. And now I am a PhD architecture student. And so I have gone from a very technical, geeky world to, with most of my life heavily, heavily documented online for 12 years, to teaching undergraduates. And being aware that at some point I'm going to be on the academic job market and people are going to Google me, to professors finding traces of me online. A couple of years ago, in a serendipitous thing where my friend who was hosting my website had to take down the server very quickly and move it, my website and years of girlwonder.com went offline, and I have not put the archives back up there. I have had to explain why I have such a trail, why things that seem personal are out there, and the fact that there's a lot more personal that I say nothing about publicly. So it is something that I need to manage, and I think something that everyone in this table is dealing with is a crossover of multiple worlds. It was the gateway kind of thing that I wanted, that I might have asked about. But I think that if you're talking to Jen, she has deep roots, for instance, in online community and the New York web world, but now is playing a different kind of role. You know, you'll see this with everybody here. So I think everybody probably deals with the changing and shifting registers in some way or another. No, absolutely not. I mean, it's undergraduates who are like, oh my God, I found your blog.
I think it's also, I think that it also it erodes the quality of certain relationships. I mean, one of the issues that I've had is that, you know, people who I'm close to, who I want to connect with in like an authentic way and have a unique conversation with, feel like they're in touch with me because they read my blog. They feel like they know what's going on in my life because they read that I went to Florent and had a burger for dinner last night. And so, you know, I mean, I think that that's part of it. And I think also it's just that you just never know how, I sort of operate from this position of thinking that like I really understand how what I put out there is going to be perceived. I'm, you know, right part of the time, but I have no idea how what I put out there, I don't have any control over how what I put out there is interpreted, right? And so, and sometimes it's interpreted in ways that are, it's not a job opportunity, it's like, it's my life.
So you've been standing a very
long
time.
Yeah, there's one question left, Tom.
Thank you. I'm fascinated with the way content moves through the web virally, and I'm also very interested in how that can be accelerated to the point of, from the point of discovery of the content to the point where it's exposed to as many people as possible. If anyone can make a suggestion of if you found a piece of content, whether a photograph or a video or whatever it was, that so touched you that you wanted so many people in the world to see it as quickly as possible, aside from your immediate networks, what would you do to get that out there to the public?
Gosh, send it to Boing Boing. Put use the Boing Boing suggest link box, I think, probably is the facile answer, which, as you'll probably tell, I specialize in. So I'll hand over to the rest of the panel.
I think the reason that he suggests Boing Boing is because it's, you know, a trusted authority by a lot of people who are super networked. So that's going to accelerate the information.
I mean, I guess there is a distinction. I mean, that maybe you've discovered like a distinction between some of the roles that we're talking about, because I think that one of the things that super colliders probably don't do so much is actually spend a lot of time getting content, particularly into networks. It's not so much about moving things out onto the network, but instead recognizing the flows in the network and coordinating those. So it's a more framework role and less of a role of, like, you know, there are definitely the people who are the discoverers of things, you know, who are more about, you know, going through, you know, every day looking at the new things on, you know, the more traditional kind of blogging roles, where there are people that really feel like they can curate the content of the network. And they're the people that I don't think we are, or at least I'm not. I think Jen does a really good job with her, in her context of doing that with the people that she's discovered. But I think that, you know, a lot of us aren't really about that as much as we are about people.
I think there are a couple of people I know who are kind of called level 60 delicious players, who kind of are just, you know, the world's best deliciouses, and I think probably getting something in front of them, as long as, you know, if it appeals to them, it's going to go a long way. But are we?
Yes, I think we're done. I just wanted to thank everyone for coming to this panel and spending some time with us and the panelists. Thank you.